Thank you, Pastor, and thank you all for welcoming me as a guest among you. Well, he said some very nice things about me. May God forgive him for his exaggerations, and may he forgive me for enjoying them. In 1807, a young missionary from the British Isles named Robert Morrison sailed halfway around the world to China. A pioneer in China. There had been no witness for Christ in China, the world's most populous nation, since a group of Christians had ventured to China in the 700s, the Nestorians. And they worked for a while in China, and there wasn't that much interest and support from back home, and eventually it ended. So from the 700s until 1807, no witness for the Lord in China. Here's one man who's going to try to make up for all those centuries of lost time. What chance did he have? Imagine the look on his face. He finds out that four other ancient religions are already on the scene in China, entrenched. Centuries of head start. Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, and in some areas of China, even Islam is already present. But he's game. He's an adventurer for God. Or is he? Look at the expression on Robert's face now. He just found out that the ancestors of the Chinese, 40 centuries or so earlier, did not sit down and invent a phonetic alphabet of 26 or so symbols like our A to Z. They decided they wanted something more complex, and they got it. They invented a writing system that utilizes hundreds of little pictures called radicals to get combined in complex ways to make Chinese words. Imagine Robert Morrison shaking his head in dismay, saying, "This writing system reminds me of chicken tracks in the mud." He may have been tempted to complain a little bit to God, saying, "Lord, where were you when they invented this? Couldn't you have exercised a little more of your marvelous capacity for sovereignty to cause them to come up with something simpler?" But he had no choice. He had to master Chinese writing. Robert found a Chinese man who had some knowledge of English and was willing to use his rather minimal knowledge of English to help Robert Morrison crack the code of Chinese grammar and amass vocabulary in the language. Sitting down one morning with his Chinese language helper, Robert gave the man his pen and said, "Please, show me which of these many symbols do you combine to make the word that means righteous in your language?" Chinese man took Robert's pen and went swish, 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 and showed him the written form of the word that means righteous. Robert saw the man had drawn two of the hundreds of possible symbols, placing one above the other. The upper symbol was the Chinese symbol for a lamb. Underneath it, another little picture that in Chinese means I, first person singular pronoun. Robert suddenly realized when the Chinese write the word that means righteous, they're actually writing the lamb over me. Means righteous. The same metaphor that John the Baptist used to introduce Jesus among the Jewish people 2,000 years ago was there, had been there for 4,000 years. Like an embedded cultural compass, a uniquely Chinese compass of a cultural kind, a kind of compass designed not to point to one place, as physical compasses do, but to point to one person. Jesus, the most magnetic personality in the universe. Do you feel the draw of his magnetism? You do? Or do? I was hoping you'd say yes. Good, and now I got some of you smiling. Great, feel free to smile. Encourage as a speaker, you know. So, Robert said to himself, well, first he said to the Chinese man, "Sir, do you know where is the lamb?" Pointed to the upper part of what the man himself had drawn, "The lamb under whom you and I must be found to be righteous in the sight of Shangti, the Lord of Heaven," the Chinese name for God. Chinese man said, "No, I don't know where that lamb is. How about you, foreigner, do you know?" Enabling Robert to say to him, "Oh, do I have good news for you and for your people." And Robert said, if there's one spiritually significant encoded message in this ancient writing system, there may be others. I must press on with my study and see what else is awaiting recognition here. Day after day, he discovered dozens and eventually more than 100 Chinese words that are spiritually significant messages encoded. He found the Chinese word for a ship requires you to draw something resembling the shape of the hull of a ship. But it doesn't mean ship until you specify the precise number of people that are sailing in it. Write any other number than the one I'm about to mention. You will lose one mark in the Chinese language exam. Well, guess what the number is? 8 people sailing in the ship. I wonder why the ancestors of the Chinese 40 centuries ago thought that 8 people in a ship was somehow significant. According to Genesis, what was the first ship that ever floated? How many people were delivered from the flood in the ark? 8 personas, 8 people in a ship. The Chinese word for covet, desiring something that doesn't belong to you, requires you to draw 2 trees and a woman making some kind of a choice between 2 trees. What could that possibly have to do with coveting? And the Chinese word for come, just the verb come, is more complex. To begin, you draw the symbol for a tree at the center, and the Chinese symbol for a tree is a tree shaped like a cross. The Chinese symbol for a man is like our letter Y turned upside down. Well, guess what is superimposed right over the center of the cross-shaped tree, an upside-down Y, a man suspended on a tree. Another part of it means mankind. And the meaning of this combination, this Chinese word for come, it reads like an encoded message. Mankind come to the man who hung on a tree. Robert Morrison blinked in amazement and said, Lord, I take it back. I think your sovereignty was manifested 4,000 years ago when the ancestors of the Chinese decided to use little pictures instead of phonetic symbols to form words. He went on to find more than 100 Chinese words that were in that category. He was the only man in the world's most populous nation with eyes to see the encoded messages and the ability to begin doing the decoding for the Chinese people. And as he learned to preach in Chinese, there were those who opposed him, calling him a foreign devil. And the Chinese had reason to resent Europeans because the British, before that time, found out the Chinese produced something very valuable called silk. But they were charging too high a price for it. So what did the British colonialists do? Brought cheap opium from India and began to introduce it in China to get the Chinese addicted to opium so they would crave it. And the British would say, the only way we can give you more opium is you give us silk in exchange. And when the Chinese realized the trick that had been pulled on them, they were very vengeful. And here came missionaries trying to overrule that treachery with the love of Christ. So it wasn't easy. But Robert Morrison soon found the Chinese people listening to him said, listen to this man. He's showing us that somehow our own ancestors anticipated the teaching he would one day bring to our nation from this otherwise foreign-sounding book. Chinese people began to turn to the Lord. And Robert went on to translate the entire Bible into Chinese, paving the way for other missionaries who followed the trail he blazed to China, who seemed to have become more famous than him. Tell me honestly, had you ever heard Robert Morrison before I said his name here this evening? If so, raise your hand, please. Oops. Next question. How many have heard of Hudson Taylor and Maria? Oh, yes, but they weren't the pioneers Robert was. Have you heard of another man born in Canada like me? I'm a U.S. citizen, but I was born in Canada. A man named Jonathan Goforth. Raise your hand if you've heard of him. A few. With a name like Goforth, how could Jonathan stay home? These and eventually a few thousand others planted the church across China until by 1949, when the communists took control of China and began to impose an atheistic government that was ruthlessly opposed to every form of religion and slaughtered somewhere between 50 million and 70 million Chinese people in the process. Chairman Mao, whom a certain czarist appointed by Obama called a hero, was one of the worst villains, most murderous people in the history of mankind. And his wife wasn't any better. She was one in heart with him. Well, half the Christians were killed by the early 1950s. And the rest were in prison, or the rest were told, unless you abandon your Christian faith, you cannot be employed by the government, you cannot be a teacher in any school, you can only be a grave digger, a garbage collector, or tillers of the fields in the communes, nothing more. And your children cannot receive public education. Because of these impositions, it's estimated another 200,000 professing Christians capitulated to the pressure of the Chinese communists and gave up, leaving 300,000 to remain faithful out of 1 million. All the missionaries were expelled. All the church buildings were confiscated and changed into communist warehouses. Christian schools confiscated and changed into schools to teach communist atheism. And those who prayed for China felt it looks grim. But as the killing stopped, a communist government appointed a committee to try to find some way to discourage the faith of the remaining 300,000 resolute Christians who refused to capitulate to the pressure. The committee met in Beijing, the capital city. And one member of the committee claimed to be an authority on Christianity. He said, "I've studied Christianity and I know where it is weak." He said, "Christianity is a religion whose adherents depend upon meetings to keep their faith strong. It's only as Christians meet together, sing their hymns together, and pray together, and quote their scriptures together that their faith is strengthened by the mutual encouragement of that sharing. So here's a simple solution. We'll send out an order. If a dozen Christians are found in one commune, we'll leave just one Christian there, or one nuclear family, and scatter the others to other communes where there are no Christians. So the Christians will not be able to readily find each other for secret Christian meetings. And in every commune, there will, of course, be obligatory attendance every morning, Christians included, to gather and hear the reading of the thoughts of Mao Zedong, the great communist leader, from the Little Red Book. Over time, the teachings of Mao will replace the teachings of Jesus in the minds of these 300,000 Christians, if we can just deny them the mutual encouragement of Christian meetings." "Thank you," said the other members of the committee. "We wouldn't have thought of an ingenious solution like that." So the order went out. As a result, the communist government of China, completely at its own expense, became the most efficient missionary sending organization in 2,000 years of church history. The Christians they scattered as thinly as possible were zealous. Their faith had been strengthened in the fires of persecution, not weakened. And yes, they did suffer from loneliness and heartache, as relatives were separated from each other, dear friends isolated from each other, perhaps never to meet again in this world. But how do the thinly scattered Christians in China solve their loneliness problem? Besides having fellowship with the Lord, they began befriending non-Christian Chinese people. They were noted for joy in spite of threats against their well-being by their own government. They were noted for honesty, integrity, compassion. And soon, more and more Chinese people were drawn to faith in Jesus through their witness, and the number of Christians in China began to grow exponentially. Now, how does exponential growth plot on a graph? Is it merely a straight line rising? How does it plot? It's an upward swooping line. It is now believed the faithful witness of the 300,000 thinly scattered Christians from the early 1950s has led to a harvest of more than 100 million born-again people in China. People who love the Lord, openly profess their faith in Him, no matter what it may cost them. The numbers are believed to be growing at 30,000 net gain a day. That's almost 1 million new believers every month. And even secular scholars are beginning to take note of what's happening in communist China. They're writing academic papers about what they call the Christianization of communist China. And the communists, meanwhile, are scratching their noggin saying, somehow we made a mistake here, and it's too late to undo it. There are so many Christians, we just have to show them a little bit of goodwill. So to show a little bit of grudging goodwill to the Christians, just because they're so numerous, they begin to give some of the warehouses back to the Christians. Christians gladly accept them back and refurbish them as the churches they originally were, and so many Christians and other curious people throng to attend these reopened churches and cities in China. They had to establish a rule for some of them, a rule that says it is forbidden for anyone to attend this church 2 Sundays in a row. Because if you do, you'll be stealing standing room only from other people that need to hear the Word of God. Elsewhere in the world, pastors are sometimes heard to say, I didn't see you in church last Sunday. In China, some pastors are more likely to be saying the opposite. Didn't I see you in church last Sunday? What are you doing here? Give your pastors that problem and they'll love you for it, right?
Yep.
Okay. So what does this mean? Did God prepare the gospel for the Jews alone? Or did he prepare it for them and for all peoples on earth? Yes. What else did he do? He prepared the Jews for the advent of Jesus in their midst, giving them foreshadowings of him, things like animal sacrifice, enabling John the Baptist to proclaim him as the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Jesus himself said to Nicodemus, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. So through the Old Testament, we find these things that are pointing forward in time to the redemption that would be revealed with the coming of our Lord into this world. But a lot of theologians have acknowledged that, but failed to grasp the fact that God has gone beyond giving these cultural compasses to the Jews and has seeded the Gentile world with them as well. So the same God who prepared this gospel for all peoples on earth has also been working to prepare all peoples on earth for the gospel. It's been a two-way preparation, not just a one-way preparation. Or is that really true? I wonder. You all know that when Jesus, conversing with Nicodemus, as recorded in John chapter 3, mentioned new birth. Nicodemus responded jubilant, said, new birth, yes, what a wonderful concept. Is that a quote or a misquote? Come on, guys. What did he say instead? He responded with a naively literal, almost childish objection to the mention of new birth, saying, how can a man be born when he's old? Can he enter his mother's womb a second time and be born? So Jesus had mentioned something that Nicodemus, the equivalent of a seminary-trained instructor of the Jewish law, didn't grasp. Now tell me, if a man with Nicodemus's background had that hard a time understanding what Jesus meant by new birth, don't you think that a naked, illiterate, head-under cannibal of a remote tribe in faraway New Guinea would have an even more difficult time understanding what new birth is all about? Nod your head if you think that would be true. Think again. There's a tribe called the Asmat, among whom Michael Rockefeller, the son of a former governor of New York State named Nelson Rockefeller, vanished, may have been killed by the Asmat. We don't know. No one's found evidence. But he vanished there. No trace ever found. The Asmat people are often at war, one Asmat village with another. But if they've been shedding each other's blood for a year or two or three, and they're sick of it, and they want peace, how do they make peace? The Asmat people from both villages will meet at neutral ground where there's a little bit of high ground with clean grass growing on it. They'll spread woven grass mats out on these little hills of high ground. maybe 3 or 4 feet above sea level, but that's a hill in Azmat terrain. Six men from each of the two villages will come and lie face down on those grass mats, each man lying face down, leaving about a foot of space between himself and his neighbor on each side. So now you've got 12 men sunbathing. And if you're an eyewitness, you're shaking your head saying, what does sunbathing have to do with making peace? But wait. The wives of these 12 men come, and each six women from each village. Each woman takes her place standing next to her husband with her ankles apart, next to him as he lies face down in front of her. So here's one woman standing, her husband lying face down, then the next woman standing next to her husband. Now 24 people are involved in the peacemaking project. Then they bring six children from each of the two villages, children of 5 years, 6 years, maybe 7 years of age, and instruct these 12 children to get down on their hands and knees. Then one child after another is urged to begin wiggling his way over the backs of the 12 fathers, squirming through between the ankles of the 12 mothers. And as each child comes through that passageway, framed in human flesh, a child from village A is picked up by people from village B and rocked like a newborn baby. And after all 12 children have come through that passageway, people from the opposite village take the children that are from an enemy community and rake off big leaves, bend the leaves around to make leaf cups, scoop up clean water, and wash all 12 children as if washing birth stains from 12 newborn babies. Then the six children from village A are taken by the people of village B back to their village for 3 days of feasting and celebrating peace, leaving their six children to be taken to village A for the same purpose. And after 3 days of feasting, all 12 children are returned to their own families in their own villages. And from that time, these two villages are at peace. Do you see why? The people from village A regard their six children as having been reborn into the kinship system of what had been an enemy village. And they welcome six children from that village as reborn into their kinship system. So now by means of these reciprocally reborn children, both communities are one great big extended family. They're all interrelated, so they don't want to kill each other anymore. They've arrived at peace through a symbolic new birth. Now suppose God has called you to be his witness to the Azmat, and they welcome you because no one who looks like you has ever killed one of them. Thank God. Often when missionaries are killed by the first by Aboriginal people at the first approach, it's not because the people were unnecessarily savage, but someone else who resembled a missionary, someone else with his skin color, had gone in earlier and killed somebody, burned a village, and stirred up a hornet's nest of vengeance. The missionary comes, maybe not even knowing about that, and is killed as a result of someone else's atrocity. But no one has done that. So the Azmat will welcome you. They know you'll probably bring medicine and steel tools to trade with them for food. So it'll be a win-win situation. They'll help you build a house. But they're not especially interested in the gospel. They're interested in you and studying you. As far as they're concerned, they're the anthropology. You're the oddball to be studied and examined culturally. But you've learned our language and you have seen how they've been at war and now how they're at peace. So you climb up into the longhouse of the typical Azmat man named Edipit. Edipit is sitting there munching on a stick of toasted beetle grubs. Just like we put marshmallows on a stick and toast them over the flame, they run a skewer through beetle grubs and toss them over the flame and pop them down one after another. little sausages, little grubs, you know. Sausages with eyes. That if he'd offers you a stick of toasted beetle grubs, you thank him for it and lay it on the mat to be taken home and eaten later, unless you develop a taste. You converse with Oedipus, and then you say to him, Oedipus, my friend, I want you to know, I was engrossed when I saw how you and your people made peace with the enemies a while ago. Oedipus, I was so amazed because what I saw reminded me of the time when I too was at war. I was at war with God in the sense that I refused to allow him to be the Lord of my life. I was using his name in horrible ways. I was trampling his laws underfoot. And when I was at war with God, life was grim for me, Oedipus. I had no peace. And I knew things were not the way they should be. But God sent a messenger to tell me that he had prepared a way where I could be at peace with him. A way whereby I could be reborn into his heavenly kinship system. A way whereby the spirit of his son, named Jesus, could be reborn within me. And I said, yes, I want that new birth. And that it be, I have experienced new birth. I am a child of God. One day I'll be welcomed into his household because I'm in his family. And God has sent me here to tell you and your people that there is a new birth, not merely a symbolic one, but a real one, at a beat whereby you can all be reborn as I have been into God's heavenly kinship system. You get about that far. Oedipus lays down what's left of a stick of toasted beetle grubs, fixes you with his gaze and says, what? You and your people have a new birth too? You see, the Osmots think they're probably the only people on the face of the earth sophisticated enough to be able to think in terms of something as abstract as new birth. You've got his attention. You say, yes, Oedipus, we have a new birth too. He will doubtless ask, is your new birth like ours? To which you reply, Oedipus, there are some similarities and there are some differences. Let me tell you about them. Now, how much chance do you think there is that Oedipus will interrupt you, say, hold on one moment, missionary. How can a man be born when he's old? Can he enter into his mother's womb a second time and be born? No chance at all. To your great surprise, you find that when it comes to reasoning about mankind's need to experience new birth, Oedipus, a naked, illiterate, heavenly cannibal of the Osmot tribe, has an advantage that Nicodemus, the equivalent of a seminary-trained Jew, did not have. Now, how can something like that be out there? Do you suppose it's there by accident? Or does it have God's fingerprints on it? Has God sovereignly overruled in the formation of Osmot culture to guarantee there would be at least this one thing in the midst of all the evil? It's like the little magnetic arrow on the dial of a compass, waiting to have the little arrow loosen on its pivot so it is free to point in the context of the teaching of the gospel to none other than Jesus. So it goes around the world. These things are out there. They've always been out there. And often when we missionaries have found these things and loosened little arrows on their dials and sealed, seen people turn to the Lord readily as a result, then we come home for a furlough. Guess what? We tended not to tell the theologians what we found out there. I guess we thought it might confuse them, might not fit into their systematic theology. We've tended to leave them in the dark, but I'm not leaving you in the dark if you're not already out of it as far as this concept is concerned, because God, who prepared the gospel for all peoples on earth, has been working to prepare all peoples on earth for the gospel. It's been a two-way preparation. And so what do missionaries have to learn to do? Be watchful. See what is meaningful to the people. Where does meaning reside? What is it in their culture that results in a remarkable change of behavior that's from negative to positive? And often it'll be something to do with making peace. And really, you know, there are things in the New Testament that warn us ahead of time to expect to find these things. What did Paul find in idol-ridden Athens? Among all the idols that he opposed, what did he find that he didn't have to oppose? An altar dedicated to an unknown God. And there's a story as to why that altar was there. It's the opening story in the book I wrote called Eternity in Their Hearts. There was a reason why the Athenians had built that altar 600 years earlier and preserved it. And Paul found it and used it as an eye-opener among the Athenians to draw their attention away from the enormous number of idols in Athens to the invisible, one true God who had delivered their city from a plague in response to a man offering a sacrifice to an unknown God 600 years before. And so, and then when John wrote the first verse of his gospel, he borrowed a term from Greek philosophy, logos. In Greek philosophy, the term logos was a term to designate a principle of constancy that is behind all the change that is happening in the universe. Is Jesus the one who was the same yesterday, today, and forever? It fits. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. Then you have what Paul wrote in Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. He said, when Gentiles who do not have the law, this special revelation from God, when they do by nature things required by the law, they're a law unto themselves, even though they do not have the law. Since they show that requirements of God's law are written where? Where did Paul say some requirements of His law are written? On their hearts. Written on the hearts of people throughout the world by the hands of the same God who wrote the Ten Commandments in Hebrew on tablets of stone and gave them to Moses, has written not all of His law, but some requirements of it in the hearts of Gentiles so that they do by nature things required by the law. That's what Paul said. And he said no, because where did he grow up? In a sheltered, did he live a sheltered life like the other disciples growing up in Jewish Galilee? No, where did he grow up? In a predominantly Gentile city called Tarsus, where people spoke Greek and the local language Cilician. So Paul rubbed shoulders with Gentiles throughout his early years and had plenty of opportunity to observe their behavior at close range. So he had observed what he comments on in Romans 2, verses 14 and 15. But those of us who have crossed new frontiers in many areas of the world have found that Paul was right again and again and again. There are requirements of God's law written on the hearts of Gentiles in very unexpected places. Like the Yali tribe in the mountains of New Guinea killed two of my missionary colleagues. And by the way, the mission that my wife Carol and I served on among out there is called World Team. Please, everyone, say World Team. Now, please say worldteam.org. Look us up on the web. Our headquarters is in Warrington, Pennsylvania. So we're a PA mission. And that's just north of Philadelphia, in case you don't know where it is. So we went to World Team, but others were there from Australia, some from Canada, and a tribe called the Yali was proving very resistant to the witness of an Australian named Stan Dale and his wife Pat. And finally the day came when Stan Dale went for a trek with a World Team missionary from Iowa, Philip Masters. And the Yali surrounded them and began shooting arrows into their bodies. They kept shooting arrows into the bodies of those two missionaries until an eyewitness later told me when I interviewed him, our arrows protruded from their bodies like reeds growing out of a swamp. Two missionary wives were widowed, each with five children to raise alone. Our hearts were heavy as we prayed. And people said, Don, you and Carol found the analogy of the peace child that I'll talk about tomorrow evening. Among the Sawi down there in the swamps, And that made it possible for them to understand the gospel and receive Jesus. And you've been suggesting there's something like this in every culture. And if we look for it, we'll find it. But nobody found anything that was useful in this special way in Yali culture. So perhaps not every culture has one of these analogies foreshadowing redemption. But later I was able to go among the Yali and do research. That's why they decided not to kill any more missionaries. And I found out, interviewing a Yali man named Adariak, that they had places of refuge. Circles of stones enclosing each one maybe half an acre of ground. Sacred ground. A wall of stones about 1 yard high. Enclosing that plot of sacred ground. And if a Yali man was ambushed by enemies or getting the worst of it in a battle, he had the option of standing, fighting, and dying maybe. He also had the option of fleeing to the wall surrounding an osawa, if there was one near. And if he reached that wall, climbed up on top of it, and jumped down onto the ground inside, as soon as the soles of his feet touched the sacred ground inside that stone wall, his worst enemies would spare his life. So it was there and had been there all along. And does that resemble anything in Old Testament law? A requirement of Old Testament law was 6 cities of refuge have to be dedicated. And if a man was accused of a crime, and if his avengers were coming to slay him for the alleged crime, he had the option of fleeing to one of the 6 cities of refuge. And Josephus, a Jewish historian, tells us roads leading to the 6 cities of refuge were the straightest roads. Bridges along those roads were kept in good repair, whereas bridges along other roads might be in disrepair. And if an accused man entered the gates of a city of refuge, he could be secure inside that city, have a place to live, a plot of ground to plant things on, and could remain there safely at least until the high priest came and arbitrated his case to decide whether he needed to be cast outside the wall of the city of refuge at the mercy of the avengers and might still be waiting out there, or remain within the city of refuge at least until the death of the high priest, if the death of the high priest preceded his own death of old age. So having places of refuge was a requirement of Old Testament law, mysteriously written on the heart of Yali cannibals. But we hadn't found out about that. But we did find out about it. And a missionary who had replaced the martyrs among the Yali, when I told him what I'd found by interviewing Arariat, he said, "Don, place of refuge in this valley? Where?" I said, "A place called Ninya, and there's others." He said, "Ninya, yeah, there's a circle of stones down there. I've walked past it. But no Yali man ever told me it's a place of refuge. Are you sure this is correct information?" He said, "Arariat doesn't know the Indonesian language all that well." So I said, "Well, John, he's not here to confirm it. But there's a group of Yali men standing over there. Let's walk over you, ask them in their own language, and we'll see what they say." He said, "Yeah, let's do that." I think he thought my view that the Yali culture was equipped with places of refuge were going to be shot out of the air before it was even 1 hour old. But we walked over, and he asked them in their own language, and they confirmed it. He said, "Why didn't you tell me that before?" And they said, "You didn't ask." But it was there. So he turned to me and said, "Don, I'm amazed. I never suspected anything like this was there to be found. But it is." And he began to think how he could proclaim Jesus as the Osawa Ovelum, the perfect place of refuge. So he did. Right there and then, when the Yali men listened. And the more they listened, the more they started making a strange clicking noise somewhere in the back of their throats. And I said to John, "What does that strange clicking noise mean?" He said, "It means they're impressed." If Yali men are impressed, they never say, "Wow, Ooh, oh, that would be unmanly. You don't let the expression on your face change. You have to remain stoic at all times. Stony face, granite face. But if they're impressed, they make that clicking noise, and you know you're getting through. Then one of them said, if only someone had explained the message about Jesus in terms such as these a few years earlier, surely we would not have killed your two friends. So, I could keep talking until midnight and beyond about these things, because I've been researching them. Some people collect rare stamps, rare coins, rare automobiles. I collect examples of God's imprinting of cultures in preparation for the gospel by library research, by interviewing missionaries, reading books, reading biographies. And what does this reveal to us about our God? Is God a communicator? Can he be a subtle communicator? Is he interested in giving people a special sign that this message of the gospel is from him for them? He does that. It doesn't guarantee that everyone who's approached in this special way will receive the gospel, but those who have heard the gospel proclaimed this way, illustrated, lumen by something in their own background, something they as a culture cherish and believe in and have practiced for a very long time. Anyone who rejects the Lord will know he's rejecting the fulfiller of that which is best, truest in his own background. And it pretty well guarantees people will receive the gospel and come to a deeper faith and a more rapid spiritual growth. It's not that any one of these things is the only thing you ever teach about. These things are the eye-openers to become heart-openers for the initial breakthrough of the gospel, establishing a foothold for redemptive truth, establishing a beachhead for the gospel. And once that foothold is established, then what do? Widen it and widen it and widen it till eventually you're teaching the whole counsel of God. But God has made it possible for these breakthroughs to facilitate an understanding that is so key. Well, my wife, Carol, I actually was married to my first wife, Carol Joy, for 44 years. Raised three sons and a daughter. All three sons are missionaries, and daughter's married to a youth pastor and serving as my secretary. We went to the Sawi, as Pastor mentioned, in 1962, served 15 years among them. But when we arrived among them, the Sawi were practicing cannibals. They were headhunters. They'd never heard of judges, jails, policemen, or law courts, and we weren't sure if they would welcome us to dinner or to be dinner. But it turned out they'd been hearing positive reports about tall, pale, sickly-looking beings called Tuans, such European types. So they were eager to welcome a Tuan. And the other tribes were saying, you'll never be that lucky. These Tuans are a rare commodity. Not enough for every tribe to have one, let alone every village. And you're the worst of all the tribes. You wretched Sawi, don't get your hopes. You'll never be favored by the presence of one of these rare beings. So the Sawi people were saying, perhaps they're right. I guess we can't claim to be anyone special. Maybe we'll never have a Tuan come and live among us to bring us medicine and steel tools to replace stone axes and machetes and knives and nylon fish line fish hooks and soap and salt and all these other rare technologies they'd just begun to hear about and desired. But they also said, just in case someday, somewhere there's a Tuan who finds out that we live here and he chooses to come and live among us, if he doesn't allow the anti-Sawi propaganda of our enemies to turn him away from us, we find out that Tuan has chosen us. We'll let him know in no uncertain terms. We choose him. He'll be our Tuan. We'll be his tribe. Well, guess what sort of a bloke you're looking at here. I'm a Tuan. My wife, Carol Joy, a Nyonya, a female Tuan. Even had a little baby Tuan, little Stephen, less than 1 year old. We arrived after a 10-hour journey by Dagatuna. I'd gone in earlier, and with the help, built a little house. Little 400 square foot thing that looked like a little matchbox with a thatch roof. I nicknamed it our thatch box. And lo and behold, standing there on the shore with the sun setting behind them were not just a few dozen men that had helped me build the thatch box, but 400 Sahwee men, women, and children. We got closer. And as the sun eased beyond the horizon behind them, the glare diminished, and I saw all the men have war paint on. They're holding weapons. What's the meaning of the weapons and the war paint? Did they decide to help me build a house and wait till I go get my family to bring back a bigger feast than just one person? And I didn't say anything to Carol. I just let her think they always look that way. Because if they're going to kill us, it's going to be over quick anyway. Why tell her it's what's going to happen? You know, you can make it a situation. The canoe slid up on the mud at their feet, and the three paddlers in the front, nervously holding their paddles, which are paddles on one end, spears on the other end, because they're from a different tribe. If we were in danger, they would be too. I lifted little Stephen up, steadied Carol as she got to her feet, walked up out of this 30-foot-long dugout canoe onto the shore, right into the midst of that armed host. They closed in all around us at Taipei. We could hardly move, and their eyes were gleaming with excitement. But the disturbing thing was they were utterly silent. Building the little house, I'd learned the Sahwee greeting, Konahari. No one was saying Konahari. Was that an ominous sign? They seemed to be waiting for a signal. Indeed, they were. Someone shouted the signal, Asa! At that signal, they all began leaping in the air, brandishing their weapons, and pounding on their drums. And as the drum beating commenced and the chanting got louder and louder, began dancing around us, edging us further and further away from the river, closer and closer to the front steps, a little thatch box about 90 yards back from the shore. And they were milling around us. And I thought, how's Carol taking this? She was smiling at the people. She was thinking, this is how they welcome you. Just got to expect it's going to be different. Little Stephen used to cry out, the wind caused the door to slam anywhere nearby. Here he was. I thought, the thunder of the drums, the leaping and shouting of all these men, he would be terrified. But he was reaching out eagerly, trying to grab white cockatoo feathers, golden bird of paradise plumes, the fluttering from the arms of the dancers, dog fang necklaces and pig tusk bracelets. He was absolutely fascinated. And I thought to myself, Lord, you're giving us your peace here. It's as if we were being baptized again, not with water this time, but with Sahwee humanity and all its strangeness. As if we're standing at the eye of a human hurricane. Have you heard that the eye of a hurricane, there's peace? You wouldn't even know. A storm is raging. And so we finally reached the front steps of the house, and they motioned to us, climb the steps. We did. We crossed the porch, went in. When I closed the door behind us, they began pounding on the drums again and danced around that house all night long. And all the next day, all the second night, and all the second day, and all the third night. By then, we were convinced we were genuinely welcome. They wore the war paint and carried the weapons in much the same way a military honor guard at Dulles International Airport wears military uniforms and holds bayonets welcoming a special guest. It was a Sahwee way of saying, welcome, Don and Carol and little Stephen, to our world. It may be crazy, but it's where we live. So I had to learn their language. How am I going to learn the language? There was no Sahwee that spoke any outside language, any language that had dictionaries, grammars published. They spoke a language for which no words had ever been put in written form. If it would ever have an alphabet, I'd have to invent one suited to it, the language. So how to learn a language when you don't have a language instructor or a book to study? You have to resort to the finger-pointing method, which means you stand among the people and start pointing at things, hoping they will understand. You want them to give you a word in their language for whatever you point at. So I began by pointing at a man. They looked at me curiously. One of them said, Didig. I wrote down, Didig means man. Then I pointed at a woman and they said, Didig. I know, it probably means person, but that regard to gender. So crossed out man, wrote person. Then I pointed at a dog and they said, Didig. I pointed at a pig, Didig. a house, a tree, a canoe, a paddler, no matter what I pointed at, they kept saying, dee 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 dee. But then I was saying, Lord, have you led me halfway around the world to learn a language that has only one word? Finally, I realized what bidig meant. Finger. It is not solid body language to point with one finger, not unless you're placing a curse on someone or something. Thank God they were giving their two on the benefit of the doubt that he wasn't placing curses on them. If they'd drawn that conclusion, I wouldn't be here to tell you about it. And they were probably muttering, this two-on is so dense. He keeps holding up his finger. We tell him the word, just keeps asking us to repeat it. Do we have to stand here all day saying nothing but finger, 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 finger? What's the point? We're all two ones as dense as this one, and we get the dumbest one that was left over. Later I found I had to learn to point with my lips. And our couch, you know what that's asking for. And this was just the beginning of a cross-cultural odyssey among 3,000 Sawi people. That's the whole tribe. When I learned the language well enough and began teaching them, one day I narrated a group of Sawi men the story of Judas, one of Jesus' disciples, turning against his friend and master and betraying him with a kiss of friendship to be led away and slain. To my dismay, they began applauding Judas, saying, Don, that man named Judas, the one who used a kiss to betray his victim. He's the sort of man we call a Tariduan, a master of treachery. Tell us more about Judas. He's the sort of man any one of us would be proud to promise a daughter to in marriage. Someone else chimed in. What Judas did to the one called Jesus is what we call tui asanaiman, using gestures of friendship merely to fatten a victim for an unsuspected slaughter. Those were not the responses I was expecting. I sat among them suddenly realizing they thought skill and treachery was a kind of admirable trait, something a man might aspire. I was to learn for the Sabi to kill a man when he expects to be killed is no sport. Make him think he's totally safe and secure and then consummate the trap. Watch the expression change on his face. That's the ideal of Tui Asanaiman. So I thought, Lord, I have a problem here. I need a gift of wisdom. You all know what the Bible says. If any man lack wisdom, let him take a further course in seminary. What is it urge first and foremost? Let him ask of God. And believe me, I was asking of God for wisdom. And God had an answer, but I'm not going to tell you this evening. Your culture calls for this message to end some minutes ago. So I'm going to have to stop and finish the story tomorrow evening with other stories of still more of these amazing cultural compasses that are out there in the world, and there's still others that have never been found, I'm sure. There are still other frontiers not yet crossed, and God may speak to your heart to go for Him and find what is waiting to be found and see what the Holy Spirit is prepared and eager to do through you by His grace. But if you can't come back tomorrow evening for the rest of the story of the peace child and the other stories, you're going to get married, go into labor, whatever. You can't get background reading. I wrote a book called Peace Child, and it's gone out in 25 different languages. And the Sawi people knew nothing about film, but they cooperated because I told them it would be worthwhile. They believed me. 1,000 of them participated in helping us produce originally a 16-millimeter movie called Peace Child. 1,000 actual Sawi men, women, and children reenacting the elements of the story that I told you, and of course the end of the story is there. And it was released in 16-millimeter in 1974. And soon was being used around the world by thousands of evangelists because it's 28 minutes long and it reveals a gospel message in a very potent, gripping way. And evangelists began giving invitations saying, you saw those wild men of the Sawi tribe in New Guinea receiving the peace child and being at peace. You need to receive God's peace child, Jesus. Come, lay your hands on Him by faith and be at peace with God. So, since 1974, the distributors of the film, which is now in DVD, with the soundtrack in 17 languages on one disc, estimate that since 1974, 1 million people in 55 nations have come to faith in Jesus through the testimony of the Sahwi Christians in that film. We had no idea. We spent those 18 days doing the filming that God was going to take it and use it. And there's some copies of it. You might want to invite Joe and I, Eileen, in for dessert in the evening and say, here's this movie. It'll catch their attention, and after it's finished, you can give your own application of the story and see if God may use it to open their hearts and minds so they'll receive more than just the calories. They'll receive the communion of the Holy Spirit as they're born again. And then I wrote a book, Lords of the Earth, about the tribe that killed my two friends in 1968, going into the Valley of Death, as we called it. And it was incredible. After 3 months after the missionaries had been slain by the Yali, a missionary pilot took off with a family on board and flew north to fly over the mountains and take them back to their home. He flew into the wrong valley. He flew into the valley where the Yali had killed the two missionaries 3 months before. Too late, he realized it was not the valley that led through the mountains, but a valley that ended against the mountains. And he was trapped. The aircraft crashed, tumbled down the face of a cliff, breaking into pieces. When the wreckage came to a stop, almost plunging into a raging river. Gasoline pouring from broken fuel lines ignited. The pilot, the father and mother, and three of the four children died in the flames, if they weren't already killed in the crash. The oldest of the four children on board, 9-year-old Paul Newman, escaped unharmed, unable to do anything to rescue anyone else as flames engulfed the wreckage. He turned and fled for his life and saw a scratch of a trail zigzagging up a mountain wall toward a village of sinister-looking pointy rooftops hundreds of feet above the crash site. He climbed that trail toward that village to seek shelter, not knowing. He was going to ask for shelter from the same Yali men who had killed the two missionaries 3 months before and were still threatening death to anyone else who came in from the outside world wearing clothes. And he had clothes on. But God was going to use that little 9-year-old orphan from Oregon as a key in his hand that would change the destiny of thousands of Yali people within a few years. And Lords of the Earth tells that story. Then as I gathered more and more of these cultural compasses, I decided I'd need to write a more encyclopedic book, not just Peace Child in depth about one instance and Lords of the Earth in depth about another instance, but an eagle's eye view. 28 case histories of these things from around the world and down through history. And after I'd written books about the people I love so dearly out there in New Guinea, I thought, you know, writing books about their culture is one way to show love for them. But there's never been an artist paint them and show what their lives are like. And I remembered as a child, I'd been an artist. I was always drawing, painting. Everybody thought I was going to grow up to be an artist. Then I realized I could paint pictures with words and not have to clean up brushes. So I became an author instead of an artist. But I said it 3 years ago. I think that ability is still there. Could I paint the scenes that are in my mind, things that no other artist has ever seen? I think I can. So I bought great big 4-foot by 3-foot canvases and acrylic paints and started painting, and one after another. And so that's another way I have of showing love. And people call them, well, they are very limited edition, and some people consider them collectibles, because I may not be around much longer, and the few posters out there may be worth something someday. Anyway, look at them, and pray about these things, because as you go to sleep tonight, please imagine in your mind uncrossed frontiers in the Muslim world, in the Buddhist world, the Hindu world, still waiting for the footfalls of the first messenger to come and bring the God-ordained message. So be a God-prepared messenger, bringing the God-prepared message to guess which kind of people on the other side of the frontier? God-prepared people. Thank you. God bless you. To be continued.